We got lots of room in, or actually we have lots of people standing out back. So there's a handful of seats scattered. Please feel free to trickle your way up. Also, we've been asked to ask y'all, if you happen to be a Microsoft employee, please give up the seat to a potential customer. So sorry about that. We can't do anything about that. However, this session is repeating Friday morning at 8:30. Yes, Friday morning, 8:30, and we will hopefully be here also to repeat. So please, if you're standing at the back, we will definitely repeat all the material then. Other than that, welcome to MMS 2012. This is the biggest MMS ever. They told us this morning 5,300 people. So getting pretty big, making a large dent in the community, so that's good. How many of you, this is your first time at MMS?
Oh my.
Nice. So how many of you are running Config Manager 2007? Even better. How many of you are running the not yet released version of the next version of Config Manager, whatever you want to call it? All right, good deal. So we're not obviously going to make any announcements. The picture here is from the MVP Summit this year. And many of you know that the product team for the longest time, and they actually met this deadline of having Config Manager 2012 done by December of last year. But of course, there were lots of interesting things that happened, and we won't even go into any of those, of why it wasn't actually released to the public. And Kim promised that he was going to camp out on the Microsoft campus in a tent on the lawn if they didn't actually release in December, because he wanted y'all to have Config Manager 2012, because we love Config Manager 2012. And so this was our picture of Kim actually camping out and demanding System Center general availability now. I think they laughed at him more than anything, but it was good anyway. So welcome to our session. Let me pull up the slide here so I can read my name properly and Kim's. There it is. So my name is Jason Sandys. I work for Adaptiva. And my esteemed colleague is Kim Opelfens. He works for Innovative, and he also does his own thing on his side. We are Config Manager MVPs, and we're here to hopefully impart a little bit, at least a little bit of knowledge, onto you about our experiences with Config Manager. Most of the things that we're going to talk about are applicable to both 2007 and 2012. We're definitely going to be focusing on 2012. We're not going to be 101, clicky-clicky, here, click here, click here. This is, you know, the basic things you need to know. What we're going to do is we're going to cover things that we see people have questions with all the time. Things on the forums that pop up all the time. And to us, sometimes it's like, okay, we've talked about this over and over. People should have this. And so that's why we want to put it into a session. So now we can point people to our session and say, look, go there. We're going to give complete detailed examples of all of these things, of why people get tripped up when they're first implementing Config Manager. So our first thing, and this is if anyone happened to attend our session last year, when we were first talking about our session last year, and it really comes up on the forums a lot, is people make a lot of bad assumptions. I mean, we do it in life. You know, it's our way we get through life, right? Is that car in front of us actually stopping when his brake lights are on? It's an assumption we make based upon experience, right? We assume that it's going to happen, and it does happen typically. But we do that in everything we do, including when we're implementing Config Manager, when we're implementing anything in IT. We have this set of experiences that we have, and we implement, or we do and we perform our different activities based upon what happened in those experiences. A lot of times, unfortunately, in IT, these things don't always work out. You really need to do your research. You really need to set up a test lab. How many of you do not have a test lab? So there's probably some people of you that don't actually raise your hand or haven't raised your hand because, you know, just because you don't want everyone else to know. But I'll submit to you that if you don't have a formal test lab, you actually do have a test lab. It's called your production environment, right? Because that's where you're actually testing things, okay? So, and that's not a good thing. So with Config Manager, it's easy to push Office 2010 to everything, right? How many of you have done that on accident, right? Very first thing you did. I had a customer one time, they actually told me that the new Config Manager guy, he actually pushed Office 2010 to everything, including their Coke machine, right? Because he just put it to all systems, that wonderful all systems collection. So really what it comes down to, make sure you know what you're doing. Test it out. Read the documentation. Don't make assumptions because, this is the way I think it actually happens. Don't do that. You're going to get yourself into a lot of trouble. So these are the kind of the five things that we picked out that people always have questions on when they're starting out with Config Manager. Even people that have been using Config Manager for a long time. There are a couple little things in here that Kim and I had to go through and look at the logs ourselves to make sure we knew what we were talking about. We don't want to make the bad assumptions. So we're going to go through each of these. We're going to swap back and forth. So the first one, client push. Very first thing you got to do with Config Manager, right? You got to get the clients out there, a client-based system or an agent-based system. Got to make sure that if that client is going to be managed, we got to get that agent out there. CCM log, the very basic log to look at. This is a server-side log, right? A lot of times on the forums, we'll tell people, go check CCM log, go check this log. And the first question always is, well, where is that log at? So CCM log, and I'm going to hop into a demo of this in a second, so we'll look at exactly where it's at. This is the first log to always look at whenever you've enabled client push. Of course, the server actually reaches out to the client. Kim will talk in a little bit how this is one of the very few times that the server ever actually reaches out to the client to do anything. So what does that imply? Well, security, number one. Sorry. Security is the first thing that it implies, right? What accounts actually get used? What does that server actually use to reach out to that client to communicate with it? So there's two things. The first one is actually the server account. So the primary site server that's doing the client push, it's his account that we're using to push out to the client. So of course he needs local admin privileges on that client to actually do all of the activities that he needs on that client to install the agent. You can put in a client agent account. Who actually deals with service accounts in here? Y'all know that that's not always fun. Somebody changes the service account. What's the one that got sent out this morning? A guy left yesterday. This is a fellow MVP sent this out on our thread. He left yesterday. They changed the domain admin account. Oh, look, antivirus doesn't work. Oh, look, I don't even know what the other examples were. They found all these things that didn't work because he was using the domain admin account to do things. So dealing with service accounts is not fun. If you can, and if you are going to implement it, use the local site server account. It makes life a lot easier. But you can definitely put in a separate set of credentials if you need to. And we'll look at that in the demo also. He's going to connect to the admin dollar folder. That's where he's actually going to start dropping files at. So how many of you have turned off admin shares? Some security guy walked down the hall reading his, or was it 2000 NSA security guide that says turn off the local admin shares? It's not a good thing to do, typically. NSA doesn't recommend doing that anymore. But if you do, right, you're going to stop. So that's why client push has all these kind of failings in it. There's all these little things that need to get set up that Config Manager can't do for you. Once it delivers the files, it actually creates a service on that client. The service actually runs in the context of that client agent. And now that client agent essentially is autonomous. It's going to install itself. The server is no longer part of this picture. So at this point, we have to switch over logs. At this point, we got to stop looking at CCM log because that's going to end with created CCM service. We'll see that in the demo. And it's going to switch over to the client context. So we need to switch over to a client-side log. CCM log is going to have all of that detail in there. Now, because it is just a service, it's just a bootstrapper, he actually has to go back to the server and pull down lots of other files. There are language packs. There are other prerequisites in 2012 like Silverlight, .NET framework, and of course the client installation itself. So it has to actually pull all those things back down from the server. So there's a two-way communication definitely going on here that needs to be open and accessible for the client agent to successfully install. Of course, we have another log file, another deep log file that we need to dig into, potentially, if there's something else going on. Client side also. And so we'll hop into the demo, since I said that like five times now. It's switching. It's switching. It didn't switch. There it goes. Okay. And of course, that mouse doesn't work. I guess I'm going to have to walk over here. So client push can definitely be done in a handful of different ways. There's auto client push, and of course, there's manual client push. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just do a quick manual client push. Everything that I talked about just now is perfectly applicable to both the auto client push and the manual client push. There's a couple little different caveats, and we'll talk about those in a few seconds. My normal Config Manager 2012 console. Is this the first time anyone's seen the new console? Actually, a handful of people. So it's not an MMC. That's normally cause for applause, but there you go. So I'm just going to pick my wonderful client here, W7 1-1. Nothing overly different than what we did in 2007, and I'm going to do my install client. Handful of things to notice on here. So I don't have multiple primary sites. I don't have secondary sites. This is a real simple demo environment. But this very first, and Zoomit's wonderful, this very first option down here at the bottom, notice we can actually pick which site we want to install the client agent from. That's something totally new in 2012, and that'll have some great benefits for folks that are going to be installing lots of sites. These other options are the same options that were always there in 2007, so excluding domain controllers, and then kind of always doing a repair type installation is that middle option there. That's it. Client push is almost so simple, and maybe this is why people get tripped up on it so often, because actually going through that wizard is so easy, and then when things don't happen, people have no idea where to look. So the first place to look is on the server itself, and that's the CCM log like we talked about. So this is always going to be wherever you installed Config Manager. So in my case, it's in E, Program Files, Config Manager, and our logs directory. How many of you are familiar with the logs directory? That's usually cause for boos and hisses sometimes, but it's actually a wonderful directory because everything you ever wanted to know about Config Manager is in the logs somewhere. Finding the log, that's another story. So I'm going to open up ccm.log. And we'll look at the tail end of that here. And I'm actually going to use our Zoomit again. And he is actually still in the process of searching for admin dollar. So we'll go up to another one that succeeded earlier today. I don't know why he's taking a few seconds. And not start link. Gotta love those scroll bars. There it was. So yes, finding things in the log file are always fun. Make sure that you're using CMTrace. That's a new tool in 2012. Oh, we did scroll down here. So this is W7.1. This is the one that we just installed. We just aren't patient enough. That's another important thing with Config Manager. Be patient. So you can see the very first thing it did up here is it actually tried to connect to the admin dollar share, just like I was talking about. It actually has to make that connection. So once again, the admin shares need to be available. We need to have permissions to get to those. We're also trying to make a connection to that IPC dollar share. So that's part of the admin shares. No one ever really sees that share. But if you turn off your admin shares, you can't selectively turn these on or off. You can't even change permissions on your admin shares. So you've got to make sure that those are actually there and intact and no one has turned them off, like some overzealous security people like to typically do. We're also going to make sure that there's no client agent installed already, unless I checked that middle checkbox that I was showing you. Which would do a reinstall, essentially. We're going to check the version. Right? We've got to make sure that we're a supported version. Sometimes the terminology there gets a little bit confusing, and that's another reason you've got to make sure you know exactly what it's doing. Now, we have this big red, ugly error in the middle there. Right? It's trying to connect to WMI, but, of course, it can't connect to WMI because it's actually looking for a previous installation of the client agent. If the client agent isn't previously installed, well, it can't connect to that WMI namespace. So that's where you get this big red error. So you can ignore that fatal error. That's an interesting way to put it. But it's essentially, it means there's no client agent already there. Now you can see we're copying CCM setup. We're actually going to copy all the client files into there. And then we're going to run CCM setup. We're actually going to create the service. And let me scroll back down. Where is the, there we go, created service. So I scrolled a little bit too far. We created our service. That's our bootstrap service to actually get things going. And that's actually on the client side. At this point, the server's out of it. There's no reason for the server to actually be part of it. And now it's all up to the client to actually install its own agent. So let's actually hop over to that client. All the log files for the client in 2012 have been moved up to the Windows directory, or at least the client installation has. And then, of course, the log files are right there in the client installation directory. So we're going into Windows. And CCM hasn't actually started on him yet, so we will go to the other client. There it is. And we have our, actually, you know what? We need to go into CCM setup. So I'm mixing myself up there. That's okay. CCM setup and Notepad. How many of you use Notepad instead of SMS Trace or CM Trace? I guess Wally's not in the room, so.
No, Wally's doing Instructor Labs.
Yeah, there you go. So I've got CM Trace right there on the desktop. CM Trace is actually part of the Config Manager 2012 installation now. If you look in the tools directory, it'll actually be there. Of course, you got to copy it around like I had to here to get it to work, but not a big deal. It's a pretty small file. So now I can open up CCM setup and see it in wonderful CM Trace. And we can see this, of course, is going to go through a lot of different things. This is a big log file. Going through all of it is well beyond going through anything here. The typical thing you want to look at here, though, is right here. Our client installation succeeded, and our successfully deleted the CCM setup service. Like I said, everything's run off of that CCM setup service. And once it's done, of course, it's going to clean itself up gracefully. If it fails, you sometimes have to go into this log file here. Does not exist when I'm with that. Drag it over into here. It must be in you. Sometimes you have to actually go into that. Let's go over here. Where is that one? He's in use. Interesting. Is it still running? Well, sometimes you have to go into that log file and actually do some detailed analysis. It's a Windows installer log file, so you actually have to know what you're doing around a Windows installer log file. Sometimes that's an easy thing to do. Sometimes that's a difficult thing to do. It's more of an art than it is actually a science. And so you actually have to kind of dig around, see what's going on. There's a lot of detail typically in Windows installer log files. And I have no idea why that file's in use. Let's do this real quick. Can I copy them? Oh, I moved it. I better be able to open it now. And as it's scrolling on the bottom and opening, we'll come back to that guy, because he is not happy right now. Oh, you know what? As soon as I switched across, there he is. So once again, this is a Windows installer log file. It's a little bit different than troubleshooting the Config Manager log files. There's really not a whole lot you can make a correspondence there. The Config Manager log files are laid out in a very specific way. If you open them in Notepad, you can actually kind of figure out what's going on. If you open one of these in Notepad, you'll see the exact same thing. There's no tagging, there's no formats like that. And you really have to do a lot of digging to get through there. There's a great blog article by a Microsoft employee that I'll put up on my blog about actually digging into that. Hopefully you won't have to, but it is, like I said, more of an art than it is actually a science.
This might be a good time to point out that CM Trace has a lot of neat features. One of them is the highlighting of errors. The highlighting of errors, as you see there, is not too bright. So everything it notices the word error in any line, it'll highlight it in red. And as you see the text, it says installation success or error, which is why it highlights, so you can safely ignore this one. It's not a true error. It just noticed that the word error was in there.
Yep. CM Trace, how many of you don't use or have never used SMS Trace? I know most of you raised your hand that you did. Is there anyone who has never used it or never touched it? So there are a couple of y'all. Just, I guess, take the advice of everyone else that raised their hand in here. Just use it, because it is a great tool. It's been around forever. It's rock solid. And, of course, you can see it scrolls dynamically, so I don't have to keep preaching on that one. So that's client setup in a nutshell as far as the demo piece actually goes. There's a few more things to talk about when we talk about client setup, though. I talked a little bit about the CCM setup and the client MSI. So the client MSI obviously is the Windows installer portion. That's the portion that actually installs the agent. CCM setup, that was that service that actually ran. It's a bootstrapper. It doesn't actually install the agent, but it does install all the prerequisites. So in 2012, there's a lot more prerequisites. There's things like language packs. There are things like Silverlight that I mentioned. There's the .NET Framework 4.0. Yes, that's actually required on the clients now, of course. But also, there's a confusion over switches that happen. So Windows Installer has its own things called public properties. These are the properties in capital letters, such as SMSMP. Those are for the MSI itself. They are not for the CCM setup. That's where you get things like /MP. The most common confusion that we see in the forums is, hey, I put /MP in, and it's not actually downloading from, or it's not actually using that as my management point. Well, that's because /MP doesn't tell it to do that. Make sure you reference the documentation to figure out each and everything that those switches do. Once again, don't make the bad assumptions. So the two links in the bottom there are talking about exactly what each and every one of those switches does, how to combine them on a command line when you're doing a script or something along those lines when you're actually doing a manual client installation. Don't make the bad assumptions. Don't just assume that it has MP in the name, that it's going to set your management point. So lots of different pros and cons here. How many of you in your organizations do use client push exclusively to get the client out there? Actually, not a whole lot, so I don't have to really preach to the choir too much on this one. Client push, as you can see, there's a lot more minuses than there actually are pluses, right? There's just that one single plus there that it's kind of quick and easy to use. Right? Like I said before, that wizard for the client push is almost so simple that it kind of lies about what is actually going on behind the scenes. But you lose a lot of things, right? The troubleshooting, it's a little more difficult to troubleshoot. It's a little more difficult to get out there because there's all those assumptions, the admin dollar shares there, that we have permissions, that the client's actually reachable from the server. Those are all assumptions that we're making are actually in place that Config Manager cannot enforce upon your infrastructure. And if they're not there, client push obviously falls down. On the pull side, so this is where you're going to actually be typing in the command line, you're going to be running it via script, you're going to be running it from a startup script, any of those type of methods to actually get the client installation running out there, a lot of good pluses there. Basically, it's comparing and contrasting those, and you guys can see those on the slides. So the best thing to say about that one is that one of the largest infrastructures in the world, 300,000 plus clients, exclusively uses startup scripts. Why? Because they don't have to deal with all these negatives that are there on the right side of the slide. They don't have to worry about that client not being available at some specific time. As soon as that client comes online, he runs the Active Directory startup script, and he's going to get the client agent. They don't have to worry about all these other weird little things that happen. Another reason to have the client pull that's not explicitly on here, kind of I alluded to before, and this is the thing that Kim's going to talk about next, is the whole communication factor. It's really embodied by all these bullet points, right? Config Manager, it's not a push methodology. It doesn't use push communications. It's a pull communication platform. So if you want to keep in that same vein, then of course you want to do your client push or your actual client installation the exact same way. And this one, much deeper than we can go into really. We talked about this one a little bit last year, but just because that CCM setup exits successfully, just because client MSI exits successfully, doesn't mean your client agent is actually functioning properly, that it's actually communicating with the server, that it's actually created its certificates, that it's actually registered itself with the management point. There's a lot of extra things that happen beyond client push. So these are caveats that come from that client communication piece that Kim's going to talk about.
So onto client communication, as Jason just said, client push is this indeed atypical behavior of Config Manager in which it actually tries to push things out. And pushing things out means that you have a whole bunch of dependencies that have to work out. Like Jason mentioned, the admin dollar share, but that also means that file and print sharing has to be enabled, that the firewall needs to allow you to pass. You need credentials to connect it with. We actually need access to the remote registry, so your remote registry service has to be able to run before client push can work. So getting all those dependencies set up just for this one-time shot to get the client installed, it's kind of a bit of overkill to just get our client out there. And our regular client communication is always initiated from the client. Communication that gets initiated from the client means I don't have to worry about firewalls, because most of the firewalls, host-based firewalls, that's blocking incoming connections. Usually they don't have a lot of firewall rules set up to block outgoing connections. So I don't have to worry about firewall. I don't have to worry about admin dollar share or file and print sharing being enabled or remote registry at all. It's just the client that initiates the initial communication and hence chooses what happens. There's actually four exceptions to that rule that we're not pushing things out. Client push is one of them, and Jason already mentioned the requirements for client push to work. There's a couple other ones where we actually push things out. That's when we use wake on LAN. If you want to use wake on LAN, then obviously the system has to wake up the remote client, so that's server-initiated communication. The out-of-band management infrastructure is another exception where you can actually power on or remotely connect to the console. How many of you have out-of-band and Intel EMT vPro stuff implemented? All right.
Does anyone see a hand anywhere?
That's what we kind of figure. We have one. Hi.
So we're not trying to make a statement, good or bad.
I'm just curious.
We're just curious
out here. Because we haven't done many implementations of it either, so kind of wondered. And remote tools is another one, but remote tools in Config Manager 2012, they finally added functionality when you enable remote tools that will configure your Windows firewall for you to make the exception, so you don't have to make the exception yourself anymore. So remote tools is actually covered by the Config Manager client installation itself. Right. So that's the client communication piece. Right. There's a couple of implications because of the way the client communication works. It's always client initiated. On the plus side, that means the only thing that actually has to work is client to server name resolution. If your name resolution doesn't necessarily allow you to look up the names of your clients, right? Since we're all client initiated, that's fine. As long as we can resolve the names of the servers, we're good to go. Right? There's no client-side or host-based firewall exceptions that you need to make. Right? Everything will just plain work because it's the client taking over the contact. And most host-based firewalls will not block outgoing communications. There's a couple of negatives to the fact that everything is client-based, right, or client-pool-based. One of them is that the server doesn't have real, true, real-life, up-to-date status on a client because it doesn't have a communication line open with the client permanently. It's the client that decides at policy polling interval or whatever interval you've set for other functionality. It's the client that decides to take up contact with the server. It's a don't call me, I'll call you kind of scenario. So in that scenario, the server only knows what it knows since the last time the client contacted it. And we don't actually have a built-in way to force a client side to actually take contact. But most of you are probably aware of a couple of community set tools that do allow you to do this. How many of you know SMS Client Sender as a tool to actually make remote connections? Okay. If you don't, please look it up. Life for a Config Manager admin with SMS Client Center is way more difficult than for an admin that does know SMS Client Center. And there's actually, next to SMS Client Center, there's actually a tool set that actually is introduced in your Config Manager console to make those actions triggerable from the console as well. We have a guy that works on that every single edition, and we're expecting a 2012 release pretty soon now. Probably pretty close to when it was actually a released product. So that's how the client communication implications actually work with who takes the contact.
All right, Pixie, how many of you are doing operating system deployment in Config Manager? About, I don't know, two-thirds or so. Anyone doing Vista? This is another one of those curious one, two. Nice.
We were being serious with that question, though.
Yeah. How many are doing XP? I'm sorry. Well, that's pretty good, though, because there's not a whole lot of hands anymore. So that was...
Wasn't all that much?
In 1 year, that's changed vastly. So that's good. I mean, Windows 7 is cool. Anyone doing Windows 8? There's one hand there, so a couple hands.
Sweet.
Didn't you also say Vista? Sorry. Okay, so... So one of the common issues that comes up is Pixie, right? Pixie's a great protocol if you know what it's doing behind the scenes, if you use it for what it's simply defined to do. And that's, of course, is to initiate the boot process. But understanding exactly how clients do that, a lot of people get tripped up in how all those things happen, because mostly this is happening at a network layer. This isn't anything that Microsoft defined. So that's one thing, right? Another thing we see in the forums, of course, is people venting on Microsoft, and why did they do this, and why did they do that? And usually, almost always, the answer for Pixie is they didn't. This has nothing to do with Microsoft. All they're doing is implementing something that was out there as an industry standard. They're relying on all the other industry partners, all the other networking folks, to actually implement it the way it's supposed to be implemented. And that's where some of the problems sometimes come in. So, basic Pixie. So you have a single subnet. How many of you have a single subnet? That's a bad question, I know. Okay, so if you have a single subnet, your server's on your single subnet, your client's on that single subnet. Although, you know, in a lot of test labs, when people first stood up Pixie, this is what they had. So when now they moved into a production environment, they couldn't understand why the Pixie communication's not working. So hopefully that'll become real clear real quick on why it's not working in those non-simple, those non-trivial environments like their labs. So in a lab environment or a very simple environment, Pixie at its very basic, I don't have a number one up here because number one's kind of assumed. It's a baseline requirement for Pixie. Once again, it's not something that Microsoft defined. I've seen people say, oh, why did Microsoft require DHCP for Pixie? They didn't. It's just the way Pixie is. You have to get an IP address from somewhere. We're doing everything dynamically on the fly. That means DHCP. So the first thing that a NIC does, this is all the NIC doing this. Remember, this isn't Windows. This isn't, once again, this isn't Microsoft. This is something that the industry has defined. They get the DHCP address, and then they put out a broadcast, if you choose the Pixie option, right, or it's hard-coded in the BIOS to do so. I'm going to put out a broadcast. Hey, any Pixie servers out there for me? I need to Pixie boot. Anybody out there? So the first Pixie server that responds is the one that's going to win. Now, because it is a broadcast, though, right, broadcasts don't cross broadcast boundaries, which are typically subnets. So that's why this communication here is limited to that single subnet. It's not going to go outside that subnet. So now if we all of a sudden introduce things that are going to block that broadcast traffic, we're obviously going to have a disruption in this very basic handshake that happens. So that's the next scenario. That's the non-trivial scenario. This is almost all cases where we've introduced that layer 3 switch, that router, something along those lines, or that extra subnet, right, is really what it comes down to. So we have it on subnet A, subnet B. Our clients are separated from our Pixie service point. So there's two solutions for that. The first and much preferred solution is called IP helpers. Once again, this is a network concept. This has nothing to do with Windows. And this is the ability of a networking device, something at layer 3, to actually forward those broadcast packets across to a destination system, a Pixie server in this case. So our client comes online, he gets our DHCP address, our number one, right, that we don't have depicted because it's just assumed. He puts out his broadcast, but oh look, our broadcasts don't go across that layer 3 device. So of course nothing happens at that point. However, we were smart enough to put our IP helper on our layer 3 device. So the IP helper specifically says, any broadcast traffic that you see, forward to this IP address. All an IP helper is. You use these for DHCP also, by the way. So you potentially end up having multiple IP helpers on that same layer 3 device. And so this traffic actually does get forwarded to multiple devices. Those devices are smart enough to know that, hey, look, this guy's looking for a Pixie server, or this guy is looking for a DHCP server. And so they're the only ones who actually respond. So in this case, we forwarded our broadcast onto our Pixie server. Our Pixie server knows the IP address of our client that was booting, so he can directly respond. We don't have to worry about any of that layer 3 stuff. It's just going to happen. And so now our Pixie server can actually respond. IP helpers are set on a per-device basis. So every one of your routers have to have these IP helpers set on it. It's at the actual network layer. Once again, this is nothing that Windows can solve for you because this is the NIC talking to your network infrastructure. So the other way to handle this one are DHCP scope options. So DHCP scope options are fun. They give lots of people heartache. Rightly so, wrongly so. That's a whole other discussion and argument. Once again, we start out with DHCP, right? We got to get our IP address. Now in this case, once we get our IP address, because we've actually set these scope options in that DHCP scope that's giving the client the IP address, in the DHCP scope options, it says, hey, Nick, here's where you need to go for your Pixie stuff. So he doesn't have to send out that broadcast. He knows exactly where to go. He has an IP address of who to contact to get the Pixie information. And you actually have to add a few other things into Pixie too, like the network boot program. But there's a couple of other little nuances like that. But in general, we're just telling it exactly where to go. So he doesn't have to worry about that broadcast not making it across the broadcast boundary. And of course, at that point, he can directly reply. So the real question is, which one of these do you use? I already kind of gave a hint to that. IP helpers are much preferred. So in Microsoft parlance, and you can actually find this in some Microsoft KB articles, they technically support IP helpers. I think that's kind of a misleading statement, because once again, it's the NIC BIOS talking to your network infrastructure. How can Microsoft really support something like that? They can't. They're going to help you with it, and they're going to tell you that's their preferred option, right? That's their option that their technical guys are going to be most comfortable with. And they're going to try to help you with other things, but that's really where the sweet spot is. It's all at the network layer. It's very basic forwarding. It's something that every time your client systems go out and get a DHCP address, they're doing the exact same thing. So it's guaranteed to work. I mean, how many of you have tried to implement DHCP and not had it work because your IP helpers didn't work? I'd say that's probably a problem of 15 years ago, right? Cisco, the other vendors, they have that down pat, and it works very well. Both of these, well, at least this one, you have to get your network team involved. How many of you dread getting your network team involved in anything? Come on, you're all lying. Everyone who's not putting up their hands is lying. So that's definitely a potential issue, right? You got to at least go talk to those guys. But it is such a simple task. They're already doing it for DHCP. So it's not something that they should really give a whole lot of heartburn about. There's some all or nothingness to the IP helpers. There's not a whole lot of granularity to it. So there are some shortcomings if you have multiple Pixie servers. There's really not a whole good way to handle that one. That's a shortfall of Pixie, though. It's not a shortfall of Microsoft's implementation, because going back to what I said before, which I won't repeat. DHCP scope options, why are they not preferred? Because they rely on the NIC vendors. How many of you love your NIC vendors and the drivers that they issue, right? That's an easy one to say, no, you don't. So there's a lot of NIC BIOSes out there. Most of them are older. They just don't handle this properly. They don't take that information that comes back from the DHCP server and don't properly communicate directly with the Pixie server. It's just a failing of their BIOS. Sometimes a BIOS upgrade helps, right? But you can never know, right? When that technician's out in the field and he boots that computer up, you've got no control over what BIOS is on that computer at that point in time. So at that point, he's kind of stuck. You also need to get the DHCP team involved. Usually that's a Windows guy, though, so it's not such a big deal, but who knows? Those guys could be somewhere sitting off in the corner, too, and so you still may have some issues there. Or maybe you're the DHCP guy, so at that point, it's pretty easy. And they're potentially granular. So you can do some other interesting things with DHCP scopes. You got some more granularity, some more leeway in exactly what you set up per subnet, per DHCP scope, obviously. But in general, because the IP helpers are so simple to actually set up, those are the ones that are greatly preferred by all folks. Site design. So
site design and CAS.
Bad transition, but
that'll be an interesting topic. How many of you think they'll? How many of you know what a CAS is? The Central Administration Site in Config Manager 2012. All right, a handful.
That's a good starting point. That's a good starting point.
That's a good starting point. Explaining what a CAS does.
How many have central sites in 2007?
A Central Administration Site is not a central site in Config Manager 2007. So if you have a central site in Config Manager 27, that doesn't necessarily mean you need a central administration site. There's actually only one reason to actually have a central administration site, and that's if you have multiple primary sites. If you'll need multiple primary sites, that's when you need a central administration site. And that's about the only reason to ever install a central administration site. Keep that in mind. Next question is obviously, okay, when do I need multiple primary sites? And we'll get to that in the next slide. In short, each primary site in Config Manager 2012 is built to handle 100,000 clients. How many of you in the room are actually managing more than 100,000 clients? I see.
Less than 10.
Less than 10 people actually have that number. If you're that amount of that size, if you're managing that many clients, you're actually in the easy spot. You're going to need a central administration site, period. It has to be there once we hit the 100,000 clients. Central administration site, as its name implies, is the site at which you centrally manage the entire hierarchy. Central administration site is the point where you're supposed to connect with your Config Manager console to and manage it from there. We'll show you an example if you don't, if you connect to any of the primary sites with your admin UI, we'll show you an example that the console doesn't show you the entire picture. You only get the entire picture from a central administration site if you have one. So we'll get into that. The central administration site will talk to the other primary sites over SQL replication. So the minute you add a central administration site, you add this additional component that you have to monitor and watch and potentially troubleshoot, although it's supposed to be fully self-healing, and we've seen it work quite well with self-healing capabilities, but, well, there's not in like a holy grail in IT, so it might break. So it's a potential component you would have to troubleshoot. When do you need a central administration site? And this slide should probably read, when do you need more than one primary site? If you have more than 100,000 clients. Another reason that is documented for having multiple primary sites, if you have large regional locations with limited connectivity. And that's a pretty specific scenario. If you have multiple locations, and more than one of those locations is not a real headquarters and some other hubs, it's multiple large locations. Because if you have one large location and smaller locations, you can get away with one primary site and multiple secondary sites. But the secondary site supportability-wise is limited to 5,000 clients. So if you have multiple locations that have more than 5,000 clients, again, you would have multiple primary sites, and again, you would have a CAS. Right? What is not a reason to have a central administration site is to have a fallback site. Right? A site to fall back to when one of the sites fails. Config Manager has quite a few things built in that allow you to build in a high availability infrastructure with the exception of the site server. Right? You cannot make the site server itself fault tolerant. All other roles can be made fault tolerant, the site server itself still cannot. That's why we see a lot of some people advocating to have a second primary site as a fallback site. Now, that misconception comes from a couple of reasons. One, it thinks that you can fail over your clients quickly to that other site. And that's actually based because we actually have a feature in Config Manager 2012, that's a bit stashed away in the properties of a site. That's called a fallback site. Right? A fallback site, so everybody figured, great. Once my client or my site infrastructure fails, I'll be able to specify a fallback site, and my clients are going to auto fail over to that fallback site. Right? That is not what that feature does. The fallback site feature that we have in the Config Manager 2012 console is there so that if your auto-assignment to a site fails, it'll assign to the fallback site. That's all it does. Nothing more, nothing less. Right? So it's just a backup mechanism for your auto-assignment rules if they're not set up correctly and they're failing. If the site fails, then all clients will still point to that same failed site and hence not communicate. Having another primary site in there, so you can switch those clients over, you'll manually have to switch those clients over. And I challenge just about anybody in this room to switch over its, all of its clients to a new site prior to a decent infrastructure being able to get set back up using the disaster recovery plan. There's just no way you're gonna switch all your clients over faster than we can implement a decent disaster recovery plan to get the site back up. So that's not a decent reason to have another primary site. Political client data segregation is another reason we hear every once in a while. But keep in mind that the central administration site, all data gets replicated everywhere in a Config Manager 2012 hierarchy, which is vastly different than what Config Manager 27 was. So client data segregation, that's not even going to work, because the data is still going to replicate around your entire hierarchy. So the data is not going to be segregated. It's still going to be everywhere. It's global data, and we'll talk about global data a little bit later. Other reasons we've heard is site role scale-out. And site role scale-out is probably a potentially good one. A Config Manager 2012 hierarchy can handle, or a primary site can handle, 5,000 distribution points. If you need more, then you'll probably need another primary site to accommodate that sort of scenario. What is not on the slide and what are reasons that we don't condone for having additional primary sites is to be future ready. We've heard that so many times, to be future ready. Just in case I'm this 10,000 seat client now, I might hit 100,000 clients sooner or later, so let's just make sure I have the CAS already. Not gonna happen anytime soon. Other reasons we've heard is future ready is, oh, if I do a merger, then I can join that other company's Config Manager 2012 to my central administration site. Right? There's a couple of problems with that sort of scenario and that baseline of thinking. One, joining or rejoining a primary site to a central administration site, as you are used to in Config Manager 27, that capability is gone. It is not there. There's no way to have a Config Manager 2012 attached to CAS at a later point in time, right? Which usually helps people saying, see, I better be ready and attach it to a CAS right now. Right? For the merger scenario, it's not going to work. You won't be able to attach it. And even if it would work, assuming they add the functionality in a later service pack or whatever, even if it would work, the end result would be a design that's not the proper design for that environment. If you would have designed that same infrastructure with the company already including the merged company, you probably would not have ended up with multiple primary sites. So attaching it to a CAS at a later stage is a quick and dirty solution to get them integrated. And once we do quick and dirty, well, we never go back to do it properly. Right? So attaching to a CAS is not an option. Means that reason to have a CAS, more than one primary site, probably means that you have more than 100,000 clients, except for the other potential scenarios, but that you'll see less often. Okay. Once you have a central administration site, then you'd better learn about...
Mine's still on. I'm still on.
You're still on?
Okay, I'm back.
Well, could you get the mic back? Okay.
We're back.
I'm going to stop saying I'm back, because each time I say I'm back, it's gone. Right. If you do have a central administration site and multiple primary sites, that actually means that you have to understand the concept of global data and instance data. Global data and instance data, global data are things that are replicated to the entire hierarchy. Means they're in all primaries, they're at the central administration site, they're just everywhere. Right? And we have listed a couple of examples of what is global data. It's collections, it's applications, it's task sequences, it's deployments, it's client settings. What we've given as a general rule is just about anything that is created by you as an administrator, that's in general global data. Right? It's not a full 100% match, but it's close. That next to that, we have instance data, or site data. Site data only gets replicated to the CAS and stays at the own site. If you do have a central administration site, this is an important concept to grasp, because it has some implications. Global data versus local data. I have this primary site A and this primary site B, and since this is two primary sites, we didn't actually draw it, but you can assume there's a central administration site somewhere at the top. We have primary site A clients sitting in a collection at primary site A. That collection is called the All Windows 7 collection. As you can see at the top left corner, we have the All Windows 7 collection at primary site A. At that point in time, I'm actually working with my admin UI connected to the primary site A server, and I'm actually creating a deployment. We noticed that deployments are global data. So that deployment in itself will replicate over first to the central administration site and then back down to primary site B. So the deployment you've created at primary site A is actually also available on primary site B. Right? We've chosen that deployment to target the All Windows 7 collection. And we noticed at primary site A that the All Windows 7 collection had five clients. You can see five linear computer icons. We have five clients in the All Windows 7 collection at primary site A. We've created that deployment, assuming we're going to deploy to those five clients. Right? However, then comes the kicker in. Collections replicate. Primary site B also gets the deployment replicated. So it has that same deployment targeted at its own All Windows 7 collection. Because what we've seen is that site data includes who's a member of the collection. That's not global data. Right? Which means that same deployment also gets activated on primary site B with more clients than what you could see at primary site A. At primary site A, if you look at the collection membership, what you'll see is your five systems. And you click deploy. And you say, I'm going to deploy to those five systems. Primary site B has another 30 that you didn't know, that you couldn't see when connecting to primary site A. And we would, instead of deploy to five, we would deploy to 35 in primary site B. Right? There's a couple of things that help you alleviate that risk. One, make sure that, as the name implies, if you have a central administration site, that your admin UI connects to the central administration site. Because the central administration site would show the All Windows 7 collection with all eight members in it. That's one thing. If you do connect to primary site B clients, what you will see is what we put up in the green screen with All Windows 7 clients. There's actually a number in between the brackets, and you'll notice that for your collections as well. That number is there. And that number is the number of clients in that collection at the central administration site. Right? So that's another thing that is global data. The number of clients in a collection, that's global data. So if you're looking at a collection and you want to deploy to it, and you see 10 resources in that collection, however, the collection count says there's 45 in there, then you know there's more that's going to be deployed than what you probably intended to do. Right? So make sure you either work from the central administration side or you work with intelligent collections so that they're only targeting the things they're supposed to target. Site design for secondaries. Right? And well, I probably should say that you need less primary sites in Config Manager 2012 because there's a lot of things that have changed that required you to have a primary site since Config Manager 27. All client settings, all your client agent settings, are done per collection. Right? So you don't need separate sites for those. Security-wise, we have the role-based access model that allows you to segregate between different groups that can manage different types of clients. So there's a lot of features that are in Config Manager 2012 that actually avoid you having additional primary sites just for those purposes. Right? Secondary sites, there's quite a few things that have changed for secondaries as well. Most notably that the client sender and the ability to throttle and schedule traffic is now available to regular distribution points as well. If you install regular distribution points, you'll now be able to schedule and throttle the traffic to the distribution point. So that kind of opens the question, why would I still install secondaries? If I have the same capabilities towards distribution points, I might no longer need secondaries. And well, we actually still need secondaries for people that are concerned with the upward flowing traffic. If you're concerned about the bandwidth of the traffic from clients going back up to the primary, that's when you install multiple secondaries. Because the secondary site and the secondary MP will then cache all that content and again use the sender and the throttle capabilities going up the chain as opposed to the sender to a regular distribution point only scheduling things down the chain. Right? So that's why you would install an additional secondary site, right? Mainly for the upward flowing traffic. There's a couple of other scenarios like deep content routing. If you want the traffic, right, a package to replicate down to a secondary site and then to another secondary site, you want to control that routing so that it doesn't all come from the primary site. That's another reason to install secondary sites. That's mainly it. Good reasons not to install secondary sites is secondary sites in Config Manager 2012, again, require a SQL Express, or a SQL, it can be a full SQL, but minimal SQL Express. A Config Manager 2012 secondary site actually has a database. It has a limited copy of what is in the primary site database. Right? That also means if you install a secondary site, you're again implementing the additional feature, the SQL replication, right, that you'll have to monitor and watch out for. As I said, was self-healing, so it's not something you have to truly monitor and control up closely, but it's that additional component that is out there once you install secondaries as opposed to distribution points. What are secondaries not for? Because we've been asked that question quite a bit. Secondaries are not gateways. Right? They're not gateways for clients in an isolated network. Why is that? Well, because the management point at a secondary site doesn't handle your very initial client registration. Client registration always has to go to the MP at the primary sites, and I'm assuming everybody is aware that clients can only assign to primary sites, not secondary sites, and that hasn't changed. Right? They do not handle site assignment, right? And they cannot be searched for in Active Directory. Right? So the scenario in here, where you have an isolated network with two firewalls and you block, the top firewall blocks all communication from the client to the primary MP, then your client will never be functional and will never be able to register. So you still need communications out there. So secondary sites are not about isolated networks and gateway functionality.
Boundaries, one of my favorite topics. So how many of you have lots and lots and lots of boundaries that you manage? So who has the most in here? Let's figure that one out. Anyone have more than 5,000? Two? Anybody more than else? 10,000 more? No? 14,000. So you got the cake. So
we have a winner.
Yeah, any of you who are whining about managing boundaries, go talk to him because he's obviously got a fun job there. So one of the problems with boundaries, and this is one of the first things that most people configured in both Config Manager 2007 and Config Manager 2012, is what in the heck are they doing for me? Early on, my concept of boundaries was definitely not right. And so through the years of answering questions, through the years of troubleshooting issues, it really comes down to these two simple concepts. And these are actually very, very clear in the Config Manager 2012 console. And I'll show you that one in a second. But we have these two things. Auto site assignment. So not site assignment, it's auto site assignment. There are other ways for clients to get assigned to your sites. They do not have to use the boundaries to actually get assigned to a site. You can manually force any client you want to talk to any other site that you want it to, or to talk to a site outside of its boundaries, obviously. The other one is content location. Where's my content at? So as a client, when I get that new deployment, whether that deployment is, oh yeah, there's a terminology change. I don't know if anyone's picked up on that. Everything's a deployment in Config Manager 2012 now. Applications, updates, task sequences, everything's a deployment. So as a client.
Which actually is great for us people that don't know how to pronounce advertisement.
Advertisements, yes.
We can do deployment.
So. Since everything is a deployment, right, as a client, when I get that deployment, I'm going to say, where's my content? Where's my content at? I'm going to ask my management point, where's my content at? The management point is going to return a list of distribution points based upon the boundaries, right? Content location, pretty simple there. But if you start mixing those two things up, you start, you know, adding other weirdnesses in there, then obviously you're going to confuse things and just going back to their basic premise. If you're making bad assumptions, weird things are going to happen on your client, and you're going to be off digging through all kinds of logs. Another new thing in Config Manager 2012 is the concept of overlapping boundaries. So as you can see on the slide, you can't actually have overlapping boundaries for site assignment, but you can have overlapping boundaries for content location. Since the majority of you in here are only going to have one site anyway, right, because you don't have 100,000 clients, the first one's not as huge of a deal, right? Big deal, I can't have overlapping boundaries. But content location, now that's where we can have overlapping boundaries. And it makes sense there, right? When that client asks the management point, hey, give me my distribution points, why can't he just merge two lists together based upon two boundaries because that client happens to fall into two of them? Well, obviously the product team finally felt the same way, and that's exactly what the client does. So when he queries, he pulls in both lists, and then he picks the best one based upon his location and the location of all those other clients that are, or all the other distribution points that are there. Now, another interesting piece of this, though, is you can actually have a site without any boundaries. There's no reason you can't do that. So for site assignment, like I said, we could force a client to be a member of a site regardless of boundaries. So we can assign a site. So how does he find his content then? Same way, except he's considered to be in this kind of default slow boundary. You're not going to see anything in the console like it. It's not really a formal concept. But he's going to be considered to be in a slow boundary, and he's going to use the slow boundary rules to actually find his content. So two very important concepts, and I think the demo's next, so we'll hop into talking about those a little bit more. So back to our wonderful 2012 console, our non-MMC, to once again re-stress that. Thank you. Okay. So the first thing to know is discoveries. So this isn't explicitly related to boundaries, but we have our boundaries actually potentially being created for us automatically based upon our wonderful, clean Active Directory sites and services. Yes, keep chuckling on that one. So basically, we have a new discovery, the Active Directory Forest discovery. And what it'll actually do, I had it open and I closed it, and our slow zoom it. So we enable it. Notice the top one, the create AD site boundaries. If you don't know why not to use AD site boundaries, go get our content from last year. Basically, the best one to use is always that bottom one. It's going to create the IP address ranges for you. Actually create all your boundaries based upon your sites and services. So now hopefully, it may not be perfect, but it's a great starting point. It's much better than having to put in 13,000 different IP address ranges or 5,000 or even if you only have 200 address ranges. If you have 200, chances are they're probably changing on a daily basis, right? Your networking team, those wonderful networking guys, love to add that new subnet out in Peoria or wherever, right? And so now you've got to go back in and modify things to make sure that the clients are actually finding their content correctly. So this is really cool. This is actually going to automatically generate based upon your actual definitions in Sites and Services. So we come down to our boundaries node, and these are all automatically generated. Nothing spectacular here, except to note, of course, that on the IPv4 ones, they're actually IP address ranges, which exactly mimics what's going on in Active Directory. It's not going to use the subnet IDs, and it's not going to use the subnet boundaries, the evil subnet boundaries. So the other thing to note is in 2012, and this is where it clearly denotes the two purposes of what boundaries are for, is just because we create a boundary, it's not actually being used yet. So it's not effective until you actually add it to a boundary group. So I have my one boundary group here. And we'll go to our references. You notice I have all my boundaries added to this boundary group. Simple demo environment. At the top here, we have use this boundary for site assignment, exactly what we were talking about. And we, of course, can tell it to use this boundary for this site. We're going to associate those two things together. And at the bottom, we have content location. So the boundaries can be used for one, both, or, of course, neither. But you know, at that point, why do you have the boundary? Whole different discussion. And, of course, we can always specify the fast and slow, just like we could in 2007. Now, to really highlight the fact that we don't need the boundaries, or what happens if we don't have boundaries, I'm going to go ahead and, I should have stayed in there, and uncheck it from the site assignment. And hop over here to assets and compliance. So we have our devices node. This is actually not a collection. This is a dynamically updated node, which is really kind of interesting. Notice I have a handful of devices. The site code column is PR1. You can see that for all of them. Go ahead and hit refresh a couple times, and notice they all just went away. All I did was hit refresh once. Now, the only ones that stayed are the clients that actually, or the systems that actually have the client agent on there. All the other systems are no longer auto-assigned, right? Pretty easy to see that one. And of course, if we go back in there, we're going to see the exact opposite. This really highlights the fact that it's just about auto-assignment. Once a client is actually assigned, so the client agent's there, he's assigned to that site, it doesn't really matter what happens with the site boundaries anymore. So I'll go back into my assets. And sometimes hitting F5 works, and sometimes we actually have to switch off the node. So there's idiosyncrasies with the new console also. But there we go. Actually, F5 a couple times and it worked. Now, it's not a collection either. You didn't see me do a collection update or anything like that. That's actually done in real time by the console itself. You can look in smsprovider.log, and you can actually see it going through and making a bunch of queries when you do those kind of things. Not sure what's going to happen in a 100,000 client environment where they have 100,000 things in there, but for very simple environments, it's pretty cool to actually get that done. So that leads us into storage. Not a great transition there either, but that's OK. Storage performance is a huge deal with Config Manager. Config Manager is built on SQL. How many people don't know that? That's a rhetorical question. But in 2012, it becomes even more important. Kim mentioned that we're using complete SQL replication now. So if your SQL falls over, if your SQL's not performing up to snuff, you're going to have even more issues, especially if you have that CAS in the picture, right? But even if you don't have that CAS in the picture, SQL is still hugely important, particularly when it comes to performance. Most Config Manager admins, they're just Windows guys. They don't know that much about storage. They ask for, hey, guys, I need this much storage, right? They give it to the SAN team. They give it to the storage team. They give it to their manager. They give it to someone else. They go, great, no problem. We're going to give you 200 gigs. We're going to give you 2 terabytes. And that's it. They just think that it's going to run, right? They think that because it's on the SAN, that the SAN is just going to magically give them performance. And we're here to tell you that we've seen many, many examples personally that that just doesn't happen, right? You can't just expect storage to be performant. And because SQL Server is so heavily reliant on storage, Config Manager also, you've got to make sure that both of those storage subsystems are very performant. So the best thing to talk about here, right, we have the multiple SQL things. Follow SQL Server best practices. Go talk to your DBAs if you happen to have them. They're kind of almost as dreaded as those network guys I know, but sometimes talking to them, you know, if you don't ask them for anything, maybe just take them to lunch or something, you're pretty good there. But they're going to want to separate all the different things out. And some of this is in the Config Manager documentation also, right? Separate out your databases from your log files, from your tempdb, from your paging file. There's lots of different things to separate out. And when I talk about separating these things out, it's not about separating them on LUNs. It's not about separating it on logical partitions. It's about actually dedicating physical spindles to each one of those components. So a lot of times the SAN teams are not going to do this kind of thing for you. It really depends upon how good your SAN is. It really depends upon how performant your SAN is. And it comes down to that magical number, the IOPS, the input output per second. There's no number that the product team is ever going to give you on this one. We've asked and they've kind of looked askance at us. It's not going to happen. You're going to have to test and you're going to have to make sure that you're going to get enough IOPS out of whatever's going on. Now, what is really going on behind the scenes, whether you're using local disks, whether you're using that SAN disk, whether you're using iSCSI, whatever you're using, those things are almost always shared resources, right? You've got a SAN, you've probably got 20, 30, 40, who knows how many different systems actually accessing that SAN. Well, that SAN has lots of shared resources. So now that complete awesome SAN that when you hook that first server up just screamed is now dividing all of its performance up among all of those different systems that are hitting it, including all the disks. Right? You're not just hitting that single disk when you're on a SAN typically. That storage team gave you a LUN, and that LUN is actually spread out a whole bunch of disks, right? They're put into a RAID array. Well, now if all of a sudden there's a lots of different resources accessing that RAID array, performance is going to go down and down and down. And now if they actually put that maybe that mainline business system on there that's hitting that database constantly on those same physical spindles, that system is now affecting your Config Manager performance. Right? So they're going to be screaming, you're going to be screaming, everyone's going to be screaming at the end of the day. So it's really about making sure that you have dedicated processing power, that you have dedicated storage performance. Right? So the processing comes up too, right? How many of you are running Config Manager in a virtual environment or plan to? A lot of people. So virtualization gets a bad name. You know, if you look at the real numbers, the overhead of virtualization is usually down in the low single digits, 2-3% at the most. As far as CPU memory and those kind of things go. The problem is that people overload things. They get great, virtualize, I'm going to put all these servers on there, and you get server sprawl, and all of a sudden that great, awesome performance of that system when it had one virtual machine on it is now divided among 10 different systems. Exact same thing happens on a SAN, right? You've got this great performant storage array on the back end, gives great output, but now as soon as you're subdividing it between multiple things calling upon that, then of course your performance is going to be subdivided, and you're going to have poor performance. Like I said, it's something that the Windows guys just normally don't have to deal with. But in this case, if you want to perform a Config Manager system, go get chummy with the storage guys. Go make sure that they're not just giving you some LUN that's already shared by a bunch of other systems out there. Or use local disk. Take control of your own destiny. Have them buy that big honking box that you can put as many disks in as you can. Now you've got control over your own destiny. Sometimes it's not possible. A lot of politics get in the way. Some of the larger organizations in the world absolutely do this. They do this today with 2007, and they're planning on doing it with 2012. Definitely something to consider for everyone. Virtual machines, once again, don't divide up your virtual machines, your VHDs, your VHDXs, your VMDXs. Once again, that's potentially a shared resource. If you divide it up too much, you're going to get worse performance. And the last new awesome feature, the killer
applications
feature.
And packages. How many of you are aware of the new feature around software distribution in Config Manager 2012, which is the old packages and programs are still in there, but the new way of doing things, the new style of doing things, is applications. Right? Applications are the new thing in there, and applications are great for a number of reasons. One of them is they're state-based. And what I've been doing when explaining applications is that applications now start acting like you expect them, or what you can expect, or what you've seen from software updates in Config Manager 27. Meaning they're enforced. They're state-based and they're enforced. Meaning that if I make a deployment for an application available to you, and I require you to install it, it will be installed. And once it is installed, and you decide to uninstall it for whatever reason, we'll reevaluate, just as we reevaluate software updates being installed, and I'll reinstall that application, at which point you can choose to uninstall it again if you have that power. And at reevaluation time, we'll reinstall it. At a certain point, one of us is going to give up. it's not going to be us. Right? How does that work? Well, to get that to work, we actually have a thing in an application called a deployment type, and a deployment type contains a detection rule. A detection rule to see whether the application is installed, yes or no. If you're going to switch to the application model, and you'll learn about the application model during this entire week quite a bit, there's quite a few sessions on the application model, but detection rules are critical to using the application model. Because as I just explained, at re-evaluation time, based on us detecting the installation, we'll either choose to reinstall or not to reinstall. If your detection method is off, you could create a deployment that reinstalls every single re-evaluation schedule, or you could create a deployment that is never going to install at all because the detection method is faulty and specifies that it's already installed anytime. Okay? So detection methods are key to getting the application model working right. Okay? Next to that, we have requirement rules. And requirement rules use actually the same engine as DCM, or the desired configuration management, in Config Manager 27. It uses that same backend engine. So if you want to start getting to know that in your current infrastructure and you don't have Config Manager 2012 just yet, just look at DCM in Config Manager 27. Not a lot of people use that feature in 27 extensively. If you do, it will make your switch to the application model all that more simple to do because you understand the concepts. Right? Other things in the application model are dependencies and supersedence, so you can have the full lifecycle of an application monitored. Right? You'll learn a lot about the application model at a lot of different sessions. There's one thing we wanted to stress quite a bit because we saw there was a bit of a confusion around that. With a new application model, and especially the conditions and the requirements, you actually have the ability to create a deployment and have your rules evaluated at runtime. Back in Config Manager 27, if we wanted to make a dynamic-based deployment, what we usually did is we created a dynamic collection. Resources would get added to that collection, and then we would start to deploy those resources. The nice thing about global conditions and the linked requirements is that we can avoid doing that and actually put it into a requirement rule and then to deploy to a larger set of machines, and the machines, just like in software updates, will figure out whether they need the application, yes or no. Because we have requirement rules, just like software updates have requirement rules for their installation, we have the same thing in the application model. So that's nice, because that means I no longer have to wait for hardware inventory to come in, hardware inventory to get readed, my collection evaluation to run, before actually the installation can occur. Okay? Because of this, some people have dreamt up the idea of, well, I won't use collections at all anymore, I'll put everything in global conditions and requirement rules, because that gets evaluated at runtime, and I don't have to create all those dynamic collections. Okay? Which is fine for a couple of rules. It is not going to work for a special subset of rules. And we actually, in our slide, we actually subdivide it in this way. If you want to check for something that can be referenced locally on the system, then by all means use global conditions. If you have something that you want to reference something centrally on a server, then you'll have to switch back to collections. And that means that for the most part, if you want to do Active Directory group-based targeting, you'll still build collections for those Active Directory groups. You'll notice that the global conditions and the requirement rules don't allow you to do group content. Right? For a couple of reasons, most likely, one of the things that probably is a reason not to do this is probably going to be scalability. If you're going to deploy to a couple of thousand systems and they all have to query your Active Directory to see whether they're in that group, that's potentially not the best situation. Right? So, and that's for any centralized resource you want to check against. So global conditions, if you want to check for something local, collections and dynamic collections, if you want to check for something that is stored centrally on the site server. Right. With that.
We took all the demo time. We had too much to say. Maybe I had too much to say. But that's the session. Please find us in the halls. Thank you for your attendance. Welcome to MMS for those who haven't been here before. definitely find us in the halls. We're wandering around. I'm at our booth. Come ask questions. We are happy to help. We love helping folks. Thanks.